The Woman's Self-Health Podcast is a place where women can go to find support, information, and tools they need to take control of their own health. We discuss the needs of women so you can become your own self-help guru. From how to manage your stress, eating for effective weight loss, real talk on self-image, maintaining lifelong health, and healthy aging, we cover it all. Be sure to visit womenssshh.com for more information on everything discussed in today's episode.
Hello and welcome to part two of our chat with Sean Webb on the Women's Self-Health Podcast. In part two of our chat with Sean, we dive a little deeper into talking about self-image and how our emotions work in developing our sense of self. We also talk about the act of resisting change, why we resist change, what is our brain and emotions doing causing us to resist that change, and the overlap between that and something like weight loss, and how our self-image and weight loss are ultimately separate but tied together. We also talk about the science behind meditation and how it can actually impact on your DNA, changing the structure of your telomeres, which allows you to live longer and reduce the stress in your life. As always, be sure to grab a pen and paper. We dive in pretty deep with Sean on this, and you're going to be wanting to take a few notes. So we hope you enjoy this episode, part two with Sean Webb. Thanks for listening. How do you explain then, if you have two individuals are afraid of the same thing, one might have a higher level of fear than necessary on one than the other?
Sure. And it's all about your perception. Well, it's two things really, right? So when you talk about a severity of emotion, and like two people can certainly have a difference in severity of an emotion for an identical situation that they find themselves in, there are a couple of factors that play into that when we're talking about the equation of emotion. The first is your expectation or preference is set by how connected you are to something. So let's say, you know, that your mom gets the flu versus a cousin that lives in Europe that you never talked to gets the flu. You learn about both in the same day. Well, you're going to have a higher level of emotional response to your mom getting the flu than you are the distant cousin who you never met, because you're more connected with your mom. And so the closer something is to the center of your self map, which is, you know, I just kind of envision this thing as a round map with different, you know, sectors of it. But basically the things that are closer to you, the things that are more dear to you are near the center. And the things that aren't so dear to you that you may still care a little bit about, but not as much as, you know, the life or death things, are out towards the edge of the map. Well, if your mom gets the flu, she's near the center of the map. So that creates a higher power emotional response than someone or something that would be out to the edge of the map. So that's part of it. And then the other part is the perception side of it and how powerful the perception is. Because if your mom calls and said, "I sneezed 5 minutes ago," okay, so that's a lower level power perception of a threat to her. You know, maybe she could be contracting a cold, or maybe she could be contracting a flu, or maybe she just got dust in her nose and sneezed. So your level of concern is much less because your power of your perception is much less. Or if she calls and says, "I have the flu," or somebody calls and says, "Your mom's in a coma in the hospital," right? Those are different perception levels of the threat. And so that increases the level of emotion that you're having based on the power of the perception and the power of your where the thing lies on your self map. So now, the difference between two people, let's say they both are connected to their job the same amount, and they both need the income the same amount. Well, one person, you know, their situation could be that they have a more rosier outlook on being able to go out and get another job. So the threat level to them losing their job is a little lower than someone who says, "Oh my God, this is my only job. And if I lose this job, I don't know what I'm going to do." And they start building it up in their mind and they let it roll out of a control, like a snowball rolling downhill that becomes a huge boulder and starts an avalanche. Well, the fear in the second person is going to be much higher because they've let their perception run out of control to say, "My job is absolutely everything my whole life, and I won't be able to pay my mortgage or my rent or my car payment or whatever if I lose this job." When the difference of the, you know, the difference between the two people is simply the difference of perception. That's it. And if they both are connected to their job the same amount, the first person says, "Well, it's going to suck if I lose this job, but I'll go out and get another one, and I'm going to be a optimistic person." And the second person, their perception is the only difference, but it could ruin their life if they let it gain out of control.
And so if we talk about the foundation for trying to eliminate or reduce the severity of those perceptions, then is it just a matter of learning, understanding the perceptions, learning how to downregulate them and using tools like affirmations or ways to increase emotional intelligence as well?
Yeah. So there's a couple of ways you can attack reducing the amount of negative emotion that you feel. One is on the perception side, and there are a number of tools that psychology has already invented, like reappraisal. Like if someone, for instance, cuts you off in traffic, and you see that as a slight to your existence, because a lot of people do. That's the science of people getting cut off in traffic is that they say, hey, that's an insult to me. Where you're going is not more important than where I'm going. You know, I legally hold this lane. You should obey the law, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So if you see it that way, you can have a higher level of anger with your perception being that they cut you off and that they say, you know, your existence doesn't matter. I'm going to take your lane. Or you could reappraise that and try to think of alternate perceptions that you could put in that place. Well, maybe they're really in a hurry. Maybe they weren't paying attention. Maybe it was completely accidental. Maybe they're a wonderful person. And then that reduces your anger response based on them accidentally cutting you off. Or maybe they're on their way to the hospital to see a dear friend who, you know, got in an accident or whatever, and they need to get there in a hurry. You know, a lot of things can change your perceptions and alter your emotional output in the heat of the moment. The other side is to address the expectation or preference side. And there are a few ways to do that. And I address a couple of them in both books, in Mind Hacking Happiness Volume 1 and Volume 2. Now, Volume 2 invents or proposes the idea of expanding your sense of self, or expanding the size of yourself out exponentially, or out wider than it is. Because if you imagine yourself as a mud puddle, let's say, and you see a problem-sized rock gets thrown into your mud puddle, it can create a big splash. It can splash the water out of the mud puddle, and you have these boats floating in the mud puddle, and it could rock your boats or even sink your boats if your life-size problem rock is thrown into your mud puddle. But at the point that you maybe start to see yourself as more than what you saw yourself as previously, and through this, I mean, we introduce the ancient disciplines of meditation and contemplative prayer and mindfulness training, things like that, to expand yourself out a little bit. So you take your mud puddle and you expand yourself out to be a size of a small pond or a lake or an ocean. Well, now you can take that same size rock, throw it in, and that same problem won't even rock your boats. It won't even create a ripple that you'll even notice. You're able to handle much more based on your expansion of your sense of self based on, you know, experiences with meditation and calming your body, et cetera, calming your mind, and getting into that space of seeing yourself as more than just your mind. Because the problem that we run into with like negative emotions when people get overwhelmed and things like that is that they look at their whole self map and they say, okay, this is me. This is who and what I am. And this whole thing really, really, really matters. And they don't realize that their equation of emotion is processing. They don't realize that their expectations or preferences are set the way they are. And they don't realize their perceptions are coming in and that they can be changed or adjusted. And they think that they're just part of that whole soup. They think that they're part of that whole process, or that they're nothing but that process. Well, when you sit in things like meditation, or you sit in things like meta-awareness, where you can actually learn about how your equation of emotion works and look at it, well, that introduces a little space in between where you are and what you're looking at. Now, the cool thing about observation and observing something is that it reminds you that there has to be a space in between yourself to perceive something. So, for instance, like a tooth can't bite itself, a fingertip can't touch itself, an eyeball can't directly see itself without like a mirror and some space in between. An olfactory nerve can't smell itself in your nose. There has to be some sort of separation. So, taking that logic one step further, if you can stop and see your mind, which you can do through meditation for thousands of years, or whether you know you've got a brand new tool in doing that now with Mind Hacking Happiness, you can actually look at your equation of emotion and you can see the things that are causing your turmoil. Well, if you can see that and you can see the operation of your mind, then there must by default be some separation between you, the observer, and the mind, what's going on. And so when you use meta-awareness to attack your sense of self, what you're doing is you're saying, okay, so this whole thing that I thought was me now, I'm able to see from a distance. So then your mind says, well, wait a second. I am now the thing that I thought I was a second ago, and I'm in this awareness that's a small distance away. So now it has to expand out. And that's how you go from the mud puddle out to the pond, out to the lake, is that you spend more and more time in that space of watching your mind, either through meditation or through meditative disciplines or through the exercise of mind hacking happiness, entering meta awareness at will. And at that point, your self expands outward. And at the point your self expands outward, then the perceptions that come into your world or come into your senses all of a sudden are trying to attack something much bigger than it was the last time that those perceptions came in. And so you can reduce the amount of negative emotional reaction that you're having by both adjusting your perceptions in the heat of the moment, saying, oh, that guy really didn't cut me off on purpose. It was probably an accident. So you can attack it on that side. Or you can say, all right, I'm going to do some contemplative practices. I'm going to do some deep breathing exercises. I'm going to do some, you know, some yoga. I'm going to do some things that expand my mind and expand my sense of self out to where my sense of self is much bigger. So the things that are attacking me now don't seem as big.
And if we talk about the emotional intelligence and using things like the meditation to improve meta-awareness, how long does it take, or what does the research kind of show in terms of that being able to change the neuroplasticity?
Oh, you'd be amazed. So Richie Davidson did one of the first studies, and he did it in conjunction at Harvard. He's a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's one of the leading researchers in the space of understanding contemplative practices and how it changes the brain. And he did a quick study of 8 weeks, and they only did 1 hour of meditation training every week. So that's, you know, 8 hours of meditation training. And they found at the end of that study, with just 8 hours or 1 hour a week over 8 weeks, which is ridiculously low for, you know, like a lot of meditators like to set a minimum of doing 20 to 30 minutes a day in meditation. Well, they did just 1 hour a week. And they found amazing results in changes in the brain structure, in the form and the function of the brain. The amygdala, which is the anger center of the limbic system, shrunk in size. Other portions of the brain that are connected with positive well-being grew in size. The anger reactions from the individuals reduced over just the 8 hours of training and beginning meditators. I mean, it was, you know, people who meditated for years and years. This is like, you know, the regular Walmart shopper of the world going in to learn how to do meditation, and under 8 hours of training, their brains changed and their life started getting better, et cetera. And at the end of it, to put an exclamation point on it, Richie took a weak flu virus, and basically squirted it up everybody's nose at the end of the study. And they had a control group who weren't meditating versus the folks who were meditating. And so all the folks who weren't meditating got sick with the flu or got the sniffles because it was weakened flu virus, and only half of the meditators got the sniffles. And so it improved their immune system response as well. It was amazing.
Yeah, I think I had this moment last year, at the end of last year, where I kind of started to get a build up of some negative emotions and was quite worn out with work. And I took a trip over to Hawaii, went over to Maui and did a retreat there for a week. And there was just nothing. There was in the middle of the rainforest. It was amazing. And I think 4 days in, I'd done a bit of meditation before, but on and off, and hadn't stuck with it for long periods. And it was 4 days solid worth of, you know, 8 hours worth of yoga and meditation a day. And by the second day, I was starting to notice a difference. And by the fourth day, it was just unbelievable the difference it made. I think on the first day, we had a 20-minute meditation in, it was the aerial yoga. So I don't know if you're familiar with that, but in the hammocks. And by the end of that, it was, you know, it was the first day I could feel kind of frustration building or thinking it was going on too long or having trouble concentrating. And by the fourth and fifth day, I was completely asleep by the end almost and completely entranced in it. It was amazing. That was just from 5 days worth.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah. You know, I mean, your body there, I mean, if you do a Google search on meditation and health benefits and, you know, put the word studies in there or whatever, you'll be amazed at how many awesome results there are. And there are no bad side effects. I mean, you know, quieting your mind and allowing your, and what it is you're shutting off your default mode network. The two networks in your brain, one is the default mode network, and the other one that we're talking about with meditation is the task mode network. And so when you're doing something, when you're focused on a task, when you're working, that's when you're in your task mode. But then 47% of the time, your mind is wandering and using this default mode network. And the default mode network is basically your ego circuits. It's your self circuits. It's the ones that's, you know, creating the daydreams and creating the imaginative situations and, you know, wishing to relive the past. You know, I should have said this, or I should have did that, or, you know, what did this mean when my boss said this, or, you know, and we're worrying about the future, like, oh man, I hope this doesn't happen, or wouldn't it be awesome if I won the lottery, or whatever it was. 47% of your day is spent in that default mode network. And the problem with that is that it is highly correlated with depression and being 20% less happy when that thing is firing. And so when you're in the task mode network, you're 20% more happy. And what you're doing in meditation is basically taking your attention. You're not doing anything else. You're just kind of sitting there focusing on your breathing, focusing on whatever it is you're supposed to be focusing on. Well, that's a task. That is doing something with your brain. And so that is shutting off your default mode, not allowing your brain to just wander and run away. And it is putting it onto a task. And that increases your health. That makes your blood pressure lower. It makes your heartbeat slower. It reduces the cortisol in your blood. I mean, these are measurable results that hundreds of studies have found now, that there are no bad side effects to meditation. And there's nothing but good stuff that happens when you're in that task mode network and meditating.
Yeah, I think a lot of the science I've read as well that completely amazed, I mean, it didn't surprise me, but I find it absolutely fascinating, is how it can actually increase the DNA telomeres as well by doing the mindfulness practice.
Oh, yeah. And that increases your length of life, according to Stanford. I mean, they found a direct correlation, right? So the telomeres are a really cool piece of science where you think of them as kind of the plastic tips on the end of your shoelaces that make your shoelaces not fray and not become shoelaces anymore. Well, the telomeres are the same things. They're the end caps on your genes that protect your DNA. And so when you lose your telomeres, and eventually you lose them, like you start losing them in your 60s, and then eventually they get too short and your DNA starts fraying off. Well, when your DNA starts fraying off, that's when you get sick and die. But the telomeres aren't just a one-way thing. You can increase the length of your telomeres by doing stuff that's healthy for you, like exercising will do it, meditation will do it, deep breathing. You know, a lot of things can increase the length of your telomeres, but meditation is one of the things that is most effective in increasing the length of your telomeres, and that directly is correlative to your length of life. When your telomeres get short and your DNA starts to fray, that's it. You're done. There's nothing you can do. But if you keep the telomeres long, you can live, you know, past 100.
Yeah, it's amazing the science that's come out, and I've seen on that as well with people. I think once you start doing it and people get into the practice of it itself, they see the benefits so quickly, and it makes such a big difference, especially to the ladies that I see and the women that I see. We're so busy with our minds all the time. And like you say, we're in that kind of default mode so often that even just changing it for a little bit of time is relief, I suppose.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, if you can just decrease and remember plasticity, right? If you're practicing something over and over again on a regular basis, that's going to change how your mind reacts in times that you're not doing something. Like, you know, a lot of times, you know, when you're just sitting and doing nothing, chilling on the couch or sitting at the beach doing nothing, your default mode network is going to be firing. It's going to be thinking about this or that or yada, yada, yada. Well, I can tell you from my experience of just, you know, practicing meta-awareness in various fashions and, you know, doing meditation and doing the disciplines that I preach for other people to do in Mind Hacking Happiness. I'm doing those all day long with my own miniature emotional reactions. The brain changes. That stuff gets a lot quieter and a lot easier to deal with. And the cool thing is, when that occurs, you know, a lot of the stress within the body is caused by the mind. It's caused by something that you don't agree with the way it is. You know, you wish this would be different. You wish you were making more money, or you wish your spouse was a little more attentive, or you wish, you know, this or that, and it's causing an imbalance in your equation of emotion. Well, that is my definition of the cause of stress, is any imbalance in the equation of emotion. And this works at a cellular level all the way up through an idea level. If there's an idea that you don't agree with, it causes stress in the body, that causes inflammation, it increases cortisol, and all of a sudden you have health problems. Well, the same is true down to the cellular level. Homeostasis is all about a balance in the system. And if everything's cool, then everything's cool. We don't have to do anything. If everything isn't cool, then that's when we're causing stress at a cellular level. And that can be explained with the equation of emotion down at the cellular level, that there's a expectation or preference that's not being met by a perception. And ironically, cell wall sensory is called perception. When a cell senses something outside itself, they scientifically call it perception. It's really cool.
Yeah, I know we're getting a bit short on time here, but there's two other really important things that I want to chat to you about as well. And that's why people become afraid of change, and also weight loss. That's a big one I see with ladies. And obviously I'm in the health and fitness and wellness industry as well. So I just want to talk to you about those two elements in terms of equation of emotion and our perceptions and how that affects our views on weight loss and why these people become so afraid of the change that needs to happen.
Yeah. Well, they're two related and two independent topics. I mean, there's an overlap there, but then there's also some independence. Let's talk about the fear of change, because that's a huge thing that almost everyone faces. And people don't understand this, but that's a physiological reaction. Now, here's why that is. So your brain is your organ of survival, going back to the very, very basics. And so going back to the very, very basics, your limbic system checks for threats to self all the time. And that's why it's throwing up ideas in front of you. It's like, oh, are you late right now? You know, is this going to be where we're supposed to be at the moment? Oh, is that a snake over there in the grass or is that a hose? Right? It's always throwing things up in front of you to check for threats to self. And then the second question must be asked, well, a threat to what? And that's where the sense of self comes in, right? Well, the sense of self is this thing that loves to remain static because, you know, you have all these past perceptions that have come through and the things in your life have already been checked for your sense of self and they're no longer considered threats. But anytime you create a change in yourself, all your perceptions, first of all, it's like, okay, now where I've known this list for a long time and it's, you know, secondhand to me, I can see a threat and quickly identify whether it is or is not a threat. I can see a perception coming in. I can identify it. Well, now there's a new list. If I change myself, well, now there's a new list that I have to check against. That I don't like that. That's not cool. So that's one thing that happens. And then the other thing that happens is when you change yourself, all of the past potential threats have to be reevaluated for this brand new list. And so your mind resists change almost at every juncture that you have an opportunity to change. It says, no, let's not do things differently because I like the way things were. This is an easy list for me to check against now. Let's not do the paperwork on all this stuff. And that's why your mind subconsciously resists change tooth and nail. It's one of the hardest things to do is to change how you're living your life, how you see yourself, you know, and it takes plasticity, it takes patience, and it takes practice to be able to change your mind to the point that it stops resisting your change. And like they were saying, you as an exercise expert probably know, it takes, you know, 15 trips to the gym minimum to get a habit going, and sometimes even more than that, to see people actually make it a habit and start a new exercise regimen that they stick with. It takes that long to work through the mind's resistance to want to change because the old self was just fine. And we're going to check all of our senses for potential threats. And it's much easier to do when we're not changing things. Let's stop moving the furniture around because I'm bumping my knees when we start to, you know, move the furniture around. And that's basically the resistance to change in a nutshell is because the mind doesn't like to change the self because the self is the thing. It is the master plan for which all threats have to be assessed against. And if the more you change it, the more difficult it is for the mind. And so en masse, people have to, but when you bring a cognitive understanding to that, and when you bring a meta-awareness to that, where you can step back and see that process, now you're gaining control over it a little bit. Now you're able to see how your mind is working, and then you can see that level of subconscious input saying, well, let's not change it. And you're like, no, sorry, we're not going to let the kids drive the bus. We're going to let the adults drive the bus now, and you can go sit in the back. Right? So you take control of that whole process, you take control of the resistance, and you're able to battle that resistance much more effectively first. So now we'll switch into losing weight because, you know, the overlap there is that, you know, a lot of times you become comfortable with the amount of weight that's on your body or the shape that's on your body, even though, like, consciously, in your waking awareness, you could say, I hate how I look. I hate, you know, the weight that I'm carrying around. I hate that, you know, I climb one set of stairs and I'm winded, you know, whatever it is. You can consciously think that, and you can consciously agree with that. Every time somebody says it every day, you can consciously be in that state, but then your subconscious is like, nope, let's not change the self. Let's not change anything, including body weight. And I was listening to a Joe Rogan podcast just recently, and it was Johan Hari who had told a story about a lady who was morbidly obese and she had lost a ton of weight. And there was a trigger for her where she started eating again and put almost all the weight back on, where the trigger was a man had hit on her. Now, this goes back to some previous trauma that she'd had where she'd been molested by an uncle, because when that uncle started molesting her, she put on a lot of weight because she thought overweight is overlooked. And that would be a defense mechanism for her in that, you know, when she had extra weight, she felt safer and she felt, you know, not sexually attractive, et cetera. Well, when she had lost the weight later in life, that trigger of sexual attraction reformulated in her mind, and she wanted to put the weight back on unconsciously and did so, and just started, you know, eating nonstop until she had gained it all back. So there's a lot of stuff that we need to battle, but it all basically can come back to sense of self, right? If you can take control of your sense of self and say, I'm going to change this, then you can start to battle those unconscious levels within your mind that will try to keep you from changing things. But it's going to be a tough process to make that change, and you have to be ready for it because, you know, half the battle is anticipating your enemy, so to speak. And the enemy in this case is going to be the resistance of your subconscious to want to change the self. And so you got to fight through that. If you fight through that, then you're taking care of the overlap issue of where the resistance to self exists and the battle for weight. That's the front line right there. Now, the other side of that is, you know, when you're trying to lose weight, you do need to keep, you know, a very conscious attention on everything that you do all day long and remain in meta-awareness and be one with your mind to where you can see the triggers of you know, whatever it is that's limiting you from, you know, losing your weight. Because a lot of times it'll be, you know, I don't want to go to the gym today. You know, I feel a little out of energy or whatever it is. I mean, it could both be your diet or it could both be, you know, your exercise regimen and the resistance to want to go exercise, et cetera. Because there are a lot of folks who are caught in the, well, I just don't have time for it today, or, you know, it's not a high enough priority, or, you know, whatever it is. That's the way, you know, that's the moment that you need to remain vigilant, take control of your mind and use it to, you know, be the adult and control what you're putting into your body and what you're doing with your body. And that's, you know, another, I guess, opportunity to use meta-awareness, because that meta-awareness place, I mean, we've used that word a few times. Let me explain it real quick. So your regular waking awareness is that place that you're seeing all the things around you right now. It's the thing that you're experiencing, hearing my voice and yada, yada, yada. That's your regular waking awareness. It's the thing that you perceive your thoughts from. That's the place where you're living. And you just kind of accept it as you. It's who and what you are, and it's what you're experiencing at the moment. Well, there's this place where you can look into what your mind is doing from a higher level of awareness. It's like a half a step up from your regular awareness. So your awareness is being in your office chair and experiencing the daydream. Well, that moment of meta awareness is when your mind says, whoop, wait a second, my mind is not doing the right thing. I'm caught in a daydream. I need to take control and I need to make a different decision. And that's when you wake up and you say, whoop, I'm daydreaming. I better get back to work. And that's a moment of meta awareness. So everybody has them. It's that moment where your mind looks in on itself. And at the point that you can look in on your mind from meta-awareness, you can take control of your mind. I call it the control room of the mind. And at the point that you're trying to lose weight and you're getting resistance from your mind on, well, you know, this, I could do one more day with this, you know, chocolate milkshake, or, you know, I don't have enough time or don't have enough energy to exercise today, right? Those are the resistive thoughts. That when you jump into meta-awareness and you say, okay, let me look what my mind is doing. My mind is resisting me from attaining my goal to lose weight. But when you jump into that space of meta-awareness, that's when you can change what your mind is doing. That's your mind's control room. So you can sit there and say, okay, no, I understand, you know, this other level of consciousness in my mind wants to resist this change, but we're going to do it anyway. But I'm going to have the salad anyway. You know, I'm going to have my kale chips anyway. I'm going to skip the dessert anyway. Yes, I hear you. I recognize that you're making noise in my mind, trying to resist the change that I want to make, but we're going to do this anyway. And that's when you step into meta-awareness to say, okay, I understand what my mind is doing, but no, I'm going to be the adult and I'm going to take control of, you know, not putting this into my body, and or I'm going to take control and I'm going to get in the car and I'm going to go to the gym. Even if I spend 5 minutes, I'm going to go there, right? That's the place where practice of controlling your mind basically gives you back control of your life.
Sean,
how's that?
That was awesome. I could talk to you all day about these topics, but I'm just being mindful of your time here. So where can the listeners go to find more about you, about Mind Hacking Happiness, and about the I Am podcast as well?
Yeah. Well, you know, I wrapped up the IM podcast a few years back. It was kind of the beta test of, you know, okay, will this stuff actually help folks? And the feedback was very positive. So you could probably find that some of that stuff on YouTube still. It was called I Am Spirituality. It's some of the older stuff, but I'm relaunching a Mind Hacking Happiness podcast here in the next month or so. You can go to mindhackinghappiness.com. The webpage is already up. The books are already available. They're out on Audible. They're out on Amazon. You can get them pretty much globally, I think, although it's only in English language right now. We don't have the translations done yet. But if you go to Mind Hacking Happiness, you can get the links to like get a free book from Audible if you sign up for their free trial and stuff. So there's a lot of stuff that we're going to be rolling out here in the short term, but the books are done. The books are a great place to start. We just finished shooting a Mind Mastery 101 course that we're going to offer from the webpage. So if you just pop into Mind Hacking Happiness, that's kind of by the center for everything.
Perfect. I'll put all of that in the show notes as well. And we'll look forward to all the other stuff you're putting out, and we'll share it across so all the listeners can share that information as well.
Sure. Sorry for rambling so long.
No, it was great. Thank you so much, Sean. Thank you. It was wonderful.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It was fun. I appreciate what you're doing and trying to, you know, help folks with staying healthy and you know, taking control of their, you know, health and well-being. I mean, that's a super important function.
Yeah, I think it is. And they're always the people that I work with as well. They're always wanting to understand their own bodies and minds better. They love learning the information. So I just thought it's such great what you're doing, and what better to share it than, well, I can strain it to the US. Why not bring it across the ditch, as you say?
Yeah, you know what? Well, you know, I've got a bunch of friends in Australia that have come from the IM podcast and from this Mind Hacking Happiness stuff. And in fact, one of your snooker players, one of your snooker champions, is we're trying to improve his mind game too, so that he can become a world champion.
This would be amazing, using this stuff with athletes. And I'd be interested to see research on that as well, using your theory with athletes as well.
Yeah, yeah. There's, you know, there's a lot of opportunity. I mean, when you start to take control of the mind, you start to, you know, a lot of athletes will be able to enter this state of flow, or they sometimes call it the zone, right? And that's the place where you're simply doing. You're not really thinking. You're just kind of living the moment. You're in it. You're just kind of exercising the talent that you have to, you know, put the ball through the hoop or the ball in the pocket or whatever it is that you're trying to do, but you're not really thinking about it. You're just kind of feeling in that moment. And entering that moment, entering that state willfully, is a huge tool, especially at the championship level, to be able to say, okay, I'm just going to turn this over to my talent, turn it over to my body. I'm not going to think about how I do something or why I do something. I'm just going to do it and feel it and be it. Well, to do that, you know, consciously, that's the best tool for any athlete ever. And so if you can figure that out, that's the master, that's the switch to mastery. And so, you know, if you take control of your mind, that's certainly a major component of it.
Absolutely. It definitely is for everything, isn't it?
It is.
Thank you so much for your time. I so, so appreciate it. And I'll be making sure to keep up with everything you're doing on Mind Hacking Happiness and find out what with the podcast and that as well.
Well, thank you for your time. I really appreciate, you know, hanging out with you and spending time. It's really amazing that this technology worked across the pond.
I know it did, didn't it?
We don't even have these long legs.
I know. Well, thank you so much. Well, you take care.
You as well.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to part two of our interview with Sean Webb on the Women's Self-Health Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you would like to find out more about Sean, head over to www.thewomensselfhealthpodcast.info/Sean Webb, where you can grab more information on his books, Mind Hacking Happiness, Volume 1 and 2. If you enjoyed both our episodes with Sean, please head over to iTunes or wherever it is that you download your podcast and leave us a review. We would greatly appreciate it. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for more episodes coming up soon.